Welcome to another episode of the Professional Engineer Podcast. On this episode, I want to do a little something different here. I want to talk about a book that has inspired me as a professional engineer, and it's kind of reinvigorated a passion in me, and I want to share that with you. And that book is The Devil in the White City by Eric Larson. And I actually did a YouTube video on that, but it's a shorter version of what I really want to do, which is I want to read some passages from the book here and tell you my thoughts and how it is influencing me and some of the things that I want to work on now because of the inspiration that this book brought me. Now, this is a historical nonfiction book, and it is about the Chicago's World Fair in the 1890s, and the architects and engineers who designed the fair. There's also another story going on in the book about a serial killer who used the fair to lure his victims. I won't be talking too much about that. I hinted at that a little bit on the YouTube video I did. But on this one right here, I want to focus mainly on the architecture and engineering that went into the fair preparation. And so I have a selection of passages here, and I want to jump right into them. So the first, it started out here in the, the preamble here, where the author introduced the story and emphasized, hey, this really everything here happened. And it goes something like this. And this really kind of set the tone for me. It hyped me up to read this. And it goes, beneath the gore and smoke and loam, this book is about the evanescence of life and why some men choose to fill their brief allotment of time engaging the impossible, others in the manufacture of sorrow. In the end, it is a story of the ineluctable conflict between good and evil, daylight and darkness, the white city and the black. Now, what really struck me in that passage was the why some men choose to fill their brief allotment of time engaging the impossible. And that is kind of my inspiration, that really reading that just sparked a new sense of passion in me. I want to achieve some of the impossible things. And that is part of what this podcast is about. So the book starts out with Burnham, who is the lead architect of the Chicago's World Fair, and he's actually on a boat, and he's reflecting back on his time working on the Chicago's World Fair. And he describes it to the reader as that the fair had occurred at all, however, was something of a miracle. To build it, Burnham had confronted a legion of obstacles, any of one which could have, should have, killed it long before opening day. Together, he and his architects had conjured a dream city whose grandeur and beauty exceeded anything each singly could have imagined. Visitors wore their best clothes and most somber expressions as if entering a great cathedral. Some wept at its beauty. They tasted a new snack called Cracker Jack and a new breakfast food called shredded wheat. Whole villages had been imported from Egypt, Algeria, Dahomey, and other far-flung locales, along with their inhabitants. The Street in Cairo exhibit alone employed nearly 200 Egyptians and contained 25 distinct buildings, including a 1,500-seat theater that introduced America to a new and scandalous form of entertainment. Everything about the fair was exotic and, above all, immense. The fair had occupied over 1 square mile and filled more than 200 buildings. A single exhibit hall had enough interior volume to have housed the U.S. Capitol, the Great Pyramid, Winchester Cathedral, Madison Square Garden, and St. Paul's Cathedral, all at the same time. One structure, rejected at first as a monstrosity, became the fair's emblem. A machine so huge and terrifying that it instantly eclipsed the Tower of Alexandria Eiffel, that had so wounded America's pride. Never before had so many of history's brightest lights, including Buffalo Bill, Theodore Dreiser, Susan B. Anthony, Jane Addams, Clarence Darrow, George Westinghouse, Thomas Edison, Henry Adams, Archduke Francis Ferdinand, Nikola Tesla, Ignaz Paderewski, Philip Armour, and Marshall Field gathered in one place at one time. Richard Harding Davis called the exposition the greatest event in the history of the country since the Civil War. So when I read that passage, it got me super hyped. Mainly just a whole litany here of magnificent things, just history-making things originated from that. And particularly the passage about how one building could have housed the entire volume of the U.S. Capitol, the Great Pyramid, the Winchester Cathedral, Madison Square Garden, and St. Paul's Cathedral. That is just a monumental building to contemplate. The next is a short passage where it introduced the two architects that is mainly the focus of the book, one being Burnham, and the second his partner John Root. And it goes like this. They were Chicago's leading architects. They had pioneered the erection of tall structures and designed the first building in the country ever to be called a skyscraper. Every year, it seemed, some new building of theirs became the tallest in the world. When they moved into the Rookery at La Salle and Adams, a gorgeous light-filled structure of Root's design, they saw views of the lake and city that no one but construction workers had seen before. They knew, however, that today's event had the potential to make their success so far seem meager. And that success had to do with Chicago being selected to be the house, the home of the coming World's Fair, having won out over Washington, D.C. and New York City. This next passage that I want to share is a very short quote, and it again, it's kind of building upon the inspiration that this book has brought to me. And it goes like this. He told Sullivan in confidence that he did not expect to remain satisfied doing just houses. And this is Burnham who says this. My idea, he said, is to work up a big business, to handle big things, deal with big businessmen, and to build a big organization, for you can't handle big things unless you have an organization. And I am actually going to take action in my own personal life, which now is technically going to be a business life, on that notion. And to work back, I want to handle big things, so I need an organization in order to handle those big things, and I want to file an LLC to accomplish some big things that I still have not yet conceptualized, but I am working towards that. So the next part gets into some of the engineering that this book really did a fantastic job in portraying. This one's going to talk about Chicago's soil conditions, and the foundations that are required to support buildings, and particularly skyscrapers, in these poor soil conditions. And it goes like this. Other barriers remained. However, the most elemental of which was the bedeviling character of Chicago's soil, which prompted one engineer to describe the challenge of laying foundations in Chicago as, quote, probably not equaled for perverseness anywhere in the world, end quote. Bedrock lay 125 feet below grade, too deep for workers to reach with any degree of economy or safety using the construction methods available in the 1880s. Between this level and the surface was a mixture of sand and clay, so saturated with water that even engineers called it gumbo. It compressed under the weight of even the modest structures, and drove architects, as a matter of routine, to design their buildings with sidewalks that intersected the first story 4 inches above grade, in the hope that when the building settled and dragged the sidewalks down with it, the walks would be level. Which, yeah, that's some pretty bad soil. So how did they build in foundations like that? And in fact, John Root, Burnham's partner there, ended up coming up with a new novel way to build it. And the book describes it right here, and I look, and here goes the quote. "The solution, when Root first struck it, must have seemed too simple to be real. He envisioned digging down to the first reasonably firm layer of clay, known as hardpan, and there spreading a pad of concrete nearly 2 feet thick. On top of this, workers would set down a layer of steel rails, stretching from one end of the pad to the other, and over this a secondary layer at right angles. Succeeding layers would be arranged the same way. Once complete, this grillage of steel would be filled and covered with Portland cement to produce a broad, rigid raft that Root called a floating foundation. What he was proposing, in effect, was a stratum of artificial bedrock that would also serve as the floor of the basement. Brooks liked it." And this type of foundation is still used today in the construction of buildings. So building upon, you need a business and an organization to do big things. This quote right here, a one-liner, sticks with me well here. And it is, "Make no little plans. They have no magic to stir men's blood." Which, again, I agree. I don't want to make little plans. I want to make big plans. And I don't know what yet. We're going to find out on whatever this journey is. And also something that I found very enjoyable, which I personally would like to be able to do with myself here, is a description of Root here and his qualities, I guess is the best way to put it. And it goes like this. "Root played the organ every Sunday morning at the First Presbyterian Church. He wrote opera critiques for the Chicago Tribune. He read broadly in philosophy, science, art, and religion, and was known throughout Chicago's upper echelon for his ability to converse on almost any subject and to do so with great wit. His conversational powers were extraordinary," a friend said. "There seemed to be no subject which he had not investigated and in which he was not profoundly learned. He had a sly sense of humor. One Sunday morning, he played the organ with particular gravity. It was a while before anyone noticed that he was playing Shoo Fly. When Burnham and Root were together, one woman said, I used to always think of some big, strong tree with lightning playing around it." And the way the book talks about how well-versed he was and how broad of a learner he was, and still an engineer, makes me someone to aspire to. That is something that I would like to be. And that is the reason why I'm making this podcast and these YouTube videos on another channel. I want to be that person. So now we're jumping into the schedule magnitude of the Chicago's World Fair, the conceptualization of what the fair would be, then the design and construction, and ultimately the running of it. And to paint the picture of the magnitude of the challenge ahead of them, this passage describes it well. "The Fair's Committee on Grounds and Buildings had asked Burnham quietly to evaluate a number of locations in the city. With equal discretion, the committee assured Burnham and Root that ultimately they would direct the design and construction of the fair. For Burnham, each lost moment was a theft from the already scant fund of time allotted to build the exposition. The final fair bill signed in April by President Benjamin Harrison established a dedication day of October 12, 1892 to honor the moment 400 years earlier when Columbus had first sighted the New World. The formal opening, however, would not occur until May 1, 1893 to give Chicago more time to prepare. Even Burnham knew much of the fair would have to be ready for the dedication. That left just 26 months. So something that I enjoyed in the book that I don't think quite happens as much today, the marvels of skyscrapers being built is kind of a common occurrence nowadays. So a cornerstone ceremony is not nearly the occasion that it used to be. Now, there certainly is fanfare nowadays, but a dedication of a building or a dedication of a bridge or really a dedication of anything of monumental achievement is not covered by newspapers and news outlets around the world. It's kind of a very local thing, if that. But what this book right here, what this passage is right here, is a brief excerpt of a cornerstone ceremony that Burnham and Root partook in for one of their buildings that they designed and built. At the end of October 1890, the site question remained unresolved. And that's the site question of the Chicago's World Fair. And at the time, Burnham and Root tended to their fast-growing practice. Contractors had begun erecting two of the firm's newest, tallest Chicago skyscrapers, the Women's Christian Temperance Union Temple and the Masonic Fraternity Temple, at 21 stories, the tallest building in the world. The foundations of both were nearly finished and awaited the installation of cornerstones. With architecture and construction such a fascination in Chicago, cornerstone ceremonies became extravagant affairs. Now the passage goes on to describe the people who showed up and kind of the festivities, but that wasn't even the completion of a building. That was just the cornerstone ceremony of building the foundation. And it was attended by the mayor and a whole other slate of dignitaries. So to further reinforce that schedule, that impossible schedule that they had, here's another passage where Burnham and Root and then the landscape architect of the World's Fair, a guy named Olmsted, who also designed the New York's Central Park, those three guys, as well as a whole slate of architects and engineers, took a field trip to the ultimately decided site of where the World's Fair would be constructed. And this is their first encounter with the site location. At the park, the architects eased from the carriages, puffing blasts of steam into the frigid air. The wind picked up motes of sand that stung their cheeks and forced them to shield their eyes. They stumbled over the frozen ground, Hunt wincing from the gout, cursing and disbelieving, Olmsted, his teeth inflamed, his night and ordeal of wakefulness limping from his long-ago carriage accident. The lake was gray, darkening to a band of black at the horizon. The only color in the vicinity was the frost rouge on the men's cheeks and the blue of Burnham and Olmsted's eyes. Olmsted watched for the architect's reactions. Now and then he and Burnham caught each other's glances. The architects were stunned. They gazed, Burnham said, with a feeling almost of despair. Jackson Park was 1 square mile of desolation, mostly treeless, save for pockets of various kinds of oak, burr, pin, black, and scarlet, rising from a tangled undergrowth of elder, wild plum, and willow. In the most exposed portions, there was only sand tufted with marine and prairie grasses. One writer called the park remote and repulsive, another a sandy waste of unredeemed and desert land. It was ugly, a landscape of last resort. Olmsted himself had said of Jackson Park, "If a search had been made for the least park-like ground within miles of the city, nothing better meeting the requirement could have been found." In fact, the site was even worse than it appeared. Many of the oaks were dead. Given the season, the dead were hard to distinguish from the living. The root systems of others were badly damaged. Test borings showed that the earth within the park consisted of a top layer of black soil, about 1 foot thick, followed by 2 feet of sand, then 11 feet of sand so saturated with water, Burnham wrote, it became almost like quicksand and was often given this name. The Chicago men understood the challenge that this soil presented. The New York men, accustomed to bedrock, did not. And by the way, in that sort of site conditions, they need to build the world's greatest fair that they had ever seen, one that would eclipse the Eiffel Tower and the Paris World Exposition that was a few years prior. So this scene of the book is when all the architects had conceptualized what their buildings were. They haven't designed them yet. They had conceptualized them, and this was their unveiling to the committees responsible for approving the design of these buildings. And it goes like this. All the architects, including Sullivan, seem to have been captured by the same spell. Although Sullivan later would disavow the moment, as each architect unrolled his drawings, quote, "the tension of feeling was almost painful," Burnham said. St. Gaudens, tall and lean, wearing a goatee, sat in a corner very still, like a figure sculpted from wax. On every face, Burnham saw a quiet intentness. It was clear to him now, finally, the architects understood that Chicago had been serious about its elaborate plans for the fair. Drawing after drawing was unrolled, Burnham said, and as the day passed, it was apparent that a picture had been forming in the mind of those present, a vision more grand and beautiful than hitherto presented by the richest imagination. As light began to fade, the architects lit the library's gas jets, which hissed like mildly perturbed cats. From the street below, the top floor of the rookery seemed aflame with the shifting light of the jets and the fire in the great hearth. The room was still as death, Burnham said, save for the low voice of the speaker commenting on his design. It seemed as if a great magnet held everyone in its grasp. The last drawing went up. For a few moments afterward, the silence continued. Lyman Gage, still president of the exposition, was first to move. He was a banker, tall, straight-backed, conservative in demeanor and dress, but he rose suddenly and walked to a window, trembling with emotion. "You are dreaming, gentlemen, dreaming," he whispered. "I only hope that half the vision may be realized." Now, St. Gaudens rose. He had been quiet all day. He rushed to Burnham and took his hand in his own. "I never expected to see such a moment," he said. "Look here, old fellow. Do you realize this has been the greatest meeting of artists since the 15th century?" And if you look at some of the photos of the World's Fair, you'll understand why. It really was, the photos really were incredible. And so the architects and engineers who designed the fair really were artists at that time. And they created a spectacle that caused people to faint when they saw it. So the book had a dabbling in deep foundations where that spread foundation, the floating footing, would not have been viable. And this passage is when they discover that that is the case. To make sure these properties were constant throughout the park, Burnham had his chief engineer, Abraham Gottlieb, test locations earmarked for other buildings. These tests yielded similar results until Gottlieb's men came to the site intended for George Post's gigantic manufacturers and liberal arts building, which, by the way, real quick, diatribe, that was the building that could fit the Capitol, the pyramid, the churches. That is the building that could fit it all, the massive building. And so at this building, quote, "the soil destined to support the northern half of the building showed total sediment of less than 1 inch, consistent with the rest of the park. At the southern end of the site, however, the men made a disheartening discovery. Even as workers loaded the platform, it sank 8 inches. Over the next 4 days, it settled 30 inches more and would have continued sinking if the engineers had not simply called off the test. Of course, nearly all the soil of Jackson Park was competent to support floating foundations, except the one portion designed to bear the fair's biggest and heaviest building. Here, Burnham realized contractors would have to drive piles, at least down to Hardpan, an expensive complication and a source of additional delay. The problems with this building, however, had only just begun. And throughout the book, that building is afflicted by setback after setback. People die constructing the building. Roofs collapse. There are fires. But it does get built in the end. But by no small feat. So central theme in the book up to this point is how this is the World's Fair following the Paris World's Fair, which unveiled the Eiffel Tower. And the fair was looking for the next spectacle that could one-up the Eiffel Tower. And no engineer, no architect had brought forth a concept that could solve that yet. And there were certainly ideas, but they were quite far-fetched, even for the time. And even for today, they'd be quite far-fetched. And one of them particularly struck me here. I think I actually laughed out loud when I read this one. And it goes like this. Another inventor, J.B. McComber, representing the Chicago Tower, Spiral Spring, Ascension, and Toboggan Transportation Company, proposed a tower with the height of 8,947 feet, nearly nine times the height of the Eiffel Tower. Nine times the height. With a base 1,000 feet in diameter, sunk 2,000 feet in the earth. Gosh. Elevated rails would lead from the top of the tower all the way to New York, Boston, Baltimore, and other cities. Visitors ready to conclude their visits to the fair and daring enough to ride elevators to the top would then toboggan all the way back home. As the cost of the tower and its slides is of secondary importance, McComber noted, I do not mention it here, but will furnish figures upon application. Like, the toboggan company wanted to build toboggans from Chicago that could reach New York, Boston, and Baltimore, which that was quite the grand vision. And good thing they did not try to build that, because it would have not worked in the slightest. And I don't even think today it could possibly work, even with our engineering capabilities today. A toboggan. So what I found to be interesting about here is kind of things were designed very quickly. And particularly this installation of the fair was only supposed to last for a short period of time. It was not designed to be a permanent building. So the engineers approached the design a little bit differently. They didn't necessarily account for a full lifespan design when it comes to wind and snow load. And it proved to be, quite frankly, fatal in some later on portions of the book where collapses occurred. But here was the first indication that there was a problem. So in August, Burnham's chief structural engineer, Abraham Gottlieb, made a startling disclosure. He had failed to calculate wind loads for the fair's main buildings, which quick little side note, as a structural engineer, as a bridge engineer myself, like that's complete negligence, but regardless. So Burnham ordered his key contractors, including Agnew and Company, erecting the manufacturers and liberal arts building, to stop work immediately. For months, Burnham had been combating rumors that he had forced his men to work at too fast a pace and that as a result, some of the buildings were unsafe. In Europe, press reports held that certain structures had been condemned. Now here was Gottlieb conceding a potentially catastrophic error. Gottlieb protested that even without an explicit calculation of wind loads, the buildings were strong enough. However, Burnham, I could not, however, take this view. Burnham wrote in a letter to James Dredge, editor of the influential British magazine Engineering. Burnham ordered all designs strengthened to withstand the highest winds recorded over the past 10 years. This may be going to extremes, he told Dredge, but to me it seems wise and prudent in view of the great interests involved. Gottlieb resigned. Burnham replaced him with Edward Shankland, an engineer from his own firm who possessed a national reputation as a designer of bridges. In October 24th, 1891, Burnham wrote to James Dredge to report that once again he was under fire over the issue of structural integrity. The criticism now, he wrote, is that the structures were unnecessarily strong. You can't win them all, but, you know, none of them blew down from wind, but they did have some vertical load issues and some fire safety issues as well that the book talks about. But I won't be providing any quotes on that. So, spoilers, I guess. And so finally, building upon the frustrations from Burnham on his lack of a Eiffel Tower competitor, this is where he finally gets a competitor that not only competed with the Eiffel Tower, but ultimately surpassed it with awe and spectacle. And this is a little bit longer of a passage, so bear with me, but I found this one very fun, and I think it would be enjoyable. They talk about a Saturday afternoon club where architects and engineers gather to just complain about their work and strategize for the next day of how to solve their problems. But it goes like this. The absence of an Eiffel challenger continued to frustrate Burnham. Proposals got more and more bizarre. One visionary put forth a tower 500 feet taller than the Eiffel Tower, but made entirely of logs, with a cabin at the top for shelter and refreshment. The cabin was to be a log cabin. If an engineer capable of besting Eiffel did not step forward soon, Burnham knew there simply would not be enough time left to build anything worthy of the fair. Somewhere he needed to rouse the engineers of America. The opportunity came with an invitation to give a talk to the Saturday Afternoon Club, a group of engineers who had been meeting on Saturdays at a downtown restaurant to discuss the construction challenges of the fair. There was the usual meal in multiple courses with wine, cigars, coffee, and cognac. At one table sat a 33-year-old engineer from Pittsburgh who ran a steel inspection company that had branch offices in New York and Chicago, and that already possessed the exposition contract to inspect the steel used in the fair's buildings. He had an angular face, black hair and black mustache, and dark eyes, the kind of looks soon to be coveted by an industry that Thomas Edison was just then bringing to life. He was eminently engaging and social, and he had a keen sense of humor, his partners wrote. In all gatherings, he at once became the center of attraction, having a ready command of language and a constant fund of amusing anecdotes and experiences. Like the other members of the Saturday Afternoon Club, he expected to hear Burnham discuss the challenges of building an entire city on such a short schedule, but Burnham surprised him. After asserting that the architects of America had covered themselves with glory through their exposition designs, Burnham rebuked the nation's civil engineers for failing to rise to the same level of brilliance. The engineers, Burnham charged, had contributed little or nothing either in the way of originating novel features or of showing the possibilities of modern engineering practice in America. A tremor of displeasure rolled through the room. Some distinctive feature is needed, Burnham continued. Something to take the relative position of the World's Columbian Exposition that was filled by the Eiffel Tower at the Paris Exposition. But not a tower, he said. Towers were not original. Eiffel had built a tower already. Mere bigness wasn't enough either. Something novel, original, daring, and unique must be designed and built if American engineers are to retain their prestige and standing. Some of the engineers took offense. Others acknowledged that Burnham had a point. The engineer from Pittsburgh himself cut to quick by the truth of these remarks. As he sat there among his peers, an idea came to him, like an inspiration. It arrived not as some half-formed impulse, he said, but rich in detail. He could see it and touch it, hear it as it moved through the sky. There was not much time left, but if he acted quickly to produce drawings and managed to convince the fair's Ways and Means Committee of the idea's feasibility, he believed the exposition could indeed out Eiffel. And if what happened to Eiffel happened to him, his fortune would be assured. And that man's name was George Washington Gale Ferris, as in the Ferris wheel. So this is probably one of my absolute favorite portions of the book, what came next here. And it described described well dead load and live load design characteristics. And I want to share it with you. In Pittsburgh, the young steel engineer became more convinced than ever that his challenge to the Eiffel Tower could succeed. He asked the partner in his inspection firm, W.F. Gronau, to calculate the novel forces that could play among the components of his structure. In engineering parlance, it embodied little dead load, the static weight of immobile masses of brick and steel. Nearly all of it was live load, meaning weight that changes over time, as when a train passes over a bridge. I had no precedent, Gronau said. After 3 weeks of intense work, however, he came up with a detailed specification. The number was persuasive, even to Burnham. In June, the Ways and Means Committee agreed that the thing should be built. They granted a concession. The next day, the committee revoked it. Second thoughts after a night spent dreaming of freak winds and shrieking steel and 2,000 lives gone in a wink. One member of the committee now called it a monstrosity. A chorus of engineers chanted that the thing could not be built, at least not with any margin of safety. Its young designer still did not concede defeat. However, he spent $25,000 on drawings and additional specifications and used them to recruit a cadre of investors that included two prominent engineers, Robert Hunt, head of a major Chicago firm, and Andrew Onderdonk, famous for helping construct the Canadian Pacific Railway. Soon, he sensed a change. The new man in charge of the Midway, Sol Bloom, had struck like a bolt of lightning and seemed amenable to just about anything. The more novel and startling, the better. And Burnham had gained almost limitless power over the construction and operation of the fair. The engineer readied himself for the third try. And spoilers, he ultimately did build the Ferris wheel. And actually, I kind of already spoiled a mention in the Ferris wheel, but up to this point in the book, they had talked about this structure and hadn't really gotten to too much detail of what it was, just the challenges that came to be. And this half a page here is what was the culmination of all that hype. And I remember just having a big grin on my face when I read this portion. And here it goes. In late November, the young Pittsburgh engineer once again put his proposal for out-Eiffeling Eiffel before the Ways and Means Committee. This time, in addition to drawings and specifications, he included a list of inventors, the name of prominent men on his board, and proof that he had raised enough money to finance the project to completion. On December 16, 1892, the committee granted him a concession to build his structure in the Midway Plaisance. This time, the decision held. He needed an engineer willing to go to Chicago and supervise the construction effort, and thought he knew that just the man, Luther V. Rice, assistant engineer of the Union Depot and Tunnel Company, St. Louis. His letter to Rice began, "I have on hand a great project for the World's Fair in Chicago. I am going to build a vertically revolving wheel 250 foot in diameter." Nowhere in this letter, however, did he reveal the true dimension of his vision, that this wheel would carry 36 cars, each about the size of a Pullman, each holding 60 people and equipped with its own lunch counter, and how when filled to capacity, the wheel would propel 2,160 people at a time, 300 feet into the sky over Jackson Park, a bit higher than the crown of the now six-year-old Statue of Liberty. He told Rice, "I want you at once if you can come." He signed the letter, George Washington Gale Ferris. And so that was super hype for me. So I'd like to conclude with the what to me was the highlight of the book. And it has to do with the Ferris wheel. Big surprise. And a storm that ravaged the fair. And all along, people had been saying and doubting that this thin piece of structural steel that was the Ferris wheel could survive any sort of storm. And it had its opportunity to do so. And this is that passage. Burnham's work did not cease. The pace at his office did not slow. The fair buildings were complete and all exhibits were in place. But just as surely as silver tarnishes, the fair became subject to the inevitable forces of degradation and decline and tragedy. On Sunday, July 9th, at a day of heat and stillness, the Ferris wheel became one of the most sought-after places to be, as did the basket of the Midway's captive balloon. The balloon, named Chicago, was filled with 100,000 cubic feet of hydrogen and controlled by a tether connected to a winch. By 3 o'clock afternoon, it had made 35 trips aloft to an altitude of 1,000 feet. As far as the concession's German aerialist was concerned, the day had been perfect one for ascensions, so still he estimated that a plumb line dropped from the basket would have touched the winch directly below. At 3 o'clock, however, the manager of the concession, G.F. Morgan, checked his instruments and noted a sudden decline in barometric pressure, evidence that a storm was forming. He halted the sale of new tickets and ordered his men to reel in his balloon. The operators of the Ferris wheel, he saw, did not take equivalent precautions. The wheel continued to turn. Clouds gathered, the sky purpled, and a breeze rose from the northwest. The sky sagged toward the ground, and a small funnel cloud appeared, which began wobbling south along the lakeshore towards the fair. The Ferris wheel was full of passengers, who watched with mounting concern as the funnel did its own danse du ventre, danse du ventre, across Jackson Park directly towards the Midway. At the base of the captive balloon, Manager Morgan ordered his men to grab mooring ropes and hang on tight. Within Jackson Park, the sudden shift from daylight to darkness drew Burnham outside. A powerful wind reared from all directions. Lunch wraps took flight and wheeled in the air like gulls. The sky seemed to reach into the exposition and somewhere glass shattered. Not the gentle tinkling of a window extinguished by a stone, but the hurt dog yelp of a large sheets falling to the ground. In the agriculture building, a giant pane of glass fell from the roof and shattered the table at which just a few seconds earlier a young woman had been selling candy. 6 roof panes blew from the manufacturers and liberal arts building. Exhibitors raced to cover their displays with duck cloth. The wind tore a 40 square foot segment from the dome of the machinery building and lifted the roof off the fair's Hungarian cafe. The crew of one of Olmsted's electric launches made a hasty landing to evacuate all passengers and had just begun motoring towards shelter when a burst of wind caught the boat's awning and whipped the 5-ton aircraft onto its side. The pilot and conductor swam to safety. Giant feathers rocked in the air. The 28 ostriches of the Midway Ostrich Farm bore the loss with their usual aplomb. In the wheel, riders braced themselves. One woman fainted. A passenger later wrote to Engineering News, "It took the combined effort of two of us to close the doors tight. The wind blew so hard that the raindrops appeared to be flowing almost horizontal instead of vertical. The wheel continued to turn, however, as if no wind were blowing. Passengers felt only a slight vibration." The letter writer, apparently an engineer, estimated the wind deflected the wheel to one side by only 1.5 inches. The riders watched as the wind gripped the adjacent captive balloon and tore it from the men holding it down and briefly yanked Manager Morgan into the sky. The wind pummeled the balloon as if it were an inverted punching bag, then tore it to pieces and cast shreds of its 9,000 yards of silk as far as 0.5 miles away. Morgan took the disaster calmly. "I got some pleasure out of watching the storm come up," he said, "and it was a sight of a lifetime to see the balloon go to pieces, even if it was a costly bit of sightseeing for the people who own stock in the company." Whether the storm had anything to do with the events of the next day, Monday, July 10th, can't be known, but the timing was suspicious. So at that, that concludes all the passages I wanted to read here. And if you want to know why Monday, July 10th, the timing of that day was suspicious, certainly grab this book, The Devil in the White City by Eric Larson. I think it did an exceptional job of explaining engineering, and I think you would enjoy reading it as much as I did. So I wanted to share this book with you. I hope you enjoyed it. A lot different than a typical conversational podcast. I'm still building up the confidence to bring people onto the podcast here to talk about professional engineering and the impact we can have on the world. And doing this is helping me build up that confidence. So thank you for bearing with me and have a great one. Again, this is Matt Dersheimer, and thank you very much for listening.